Today's a special day. You may notice the room is set up a little differently than it normally is. This is to help us celebrate the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous. We celebrate in this group on the Thursday closest to June 10th. June 10th, 1935, I think is the, when we take Dr. Bob's sobriety date, that's his sobriety date, as the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today's June 10th in 2004. So it's 69 years ago today. So it's rather an auspicious occasion. And so as I say, we're going to veer from our normal Thursday night format and add here to our annual tradition of celebrating AA's birthday. And we invite a speaker to come in and share on the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Believe me, it's not a lecture to be endured, but something to enjoy. And our regularly scheduled speaker was called away on very short notice. And our speaker this evening is here because that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, on very short notice as well, you know, he agreed to join us and share his perspective on the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you would please help welcome warmly our friend Chris.
Good evening, everybody. My name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, the gods, God separated me from alcohol on or around December 28th, 1989. I don't remember much of that event, but I do know that I became separated from alcohol through some desperation and some previous attendance at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I knew where I needed to go. God manifested his power in me through willingness to actually go and do that. And since walking through the doors in Alcoholics Anonymous way back then, I'm lucky enough to have not found it necessary to put alcohol or mood-altering recreational drugs in my body, which is a good thing. Sponsorship, consistent meetings, consistent attendance at meetings, and service work has enabled me to be in an atmosphere where God can keep me safe and protected from alcohol and allow me to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I'm very grateful for that. Mike called me up today and he asked me if I would come up and share my perspective on the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm really glad to do that. I study history in a lot of different areas. During a period of time, I'd say about 8 to 10 years ago, I studied a lot of AA history. I got very interested in it. I read all the books, all the, you know, the 24 Dick B books I read, you know, the Not God, all the conference approved stuff, but I like the non-conference approved stuff. You know what I'm saying? The stuff that really, you know, warts and all type of literature. So I'm well-rounded with the academic, portion of our history. Well, some of the writers of history that I enjoy, explain something this way when talking about spiritual literature. And I'll start off to kind of give you an idea of how I approach these things. Not everything I say is going to be accurate. In other words, if you were back in time and you had a VCR camera on these events, it probably wouldn't have taken place exactly the way I'm describing. But that doesn't make what I'm describing not true. So it may not be accurate, but the story is true. The more you learn about Bill Wilson, the more you learn that he was inaccurate with a lot of his statements and a lot of his you know, he said that, you know, him and Ebby were in the living room on like a Thursday or so, and that's not what Ebby remembered, you know, so exactly what I'm going to be talking about may not be accurate, but the story is true. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, to start off with Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to go back earlier in time to the around 1860. Alcoholism, I don't need to tell anybody in here, we've all experienced it. It's a progressively fatal malady that takes you out quickly or it takes you out slowly. You have very little chance of conquering it on your own. We all know that. However, there have been some periods of time in the past where individuals have been able to band together and overcome alcoholism, at least on a temporary basis. And one of these times was when a group of people who had recognized their alcohol consumption as maybe a bit abnormal got together in Baltimore. And this was at a period of time where there was a lot of temperance movements. Now, we don't cotton to temperance movements, you know, in this part of the century. You know what I'm saying? Somebody coming up to us making us sign a statement declaring that we'll never drink for the rest of, you know, we don't go into that stuff these days. But back in the mid-1800s, there were people going around to bars and trying to sign people up with these temperance pledges. And there was temperance movements and there was abolition, you know, movement, you know, like trying to abolish all alcohol. And it was just a different period of time. And these six individuals, I believe it was six, I'm numerically dyslexic, so I'll get dates and numbers and times and everything wrong. But again, that doesn't make it not true. Anyway, these six guys from Baltimore decide to get together and stick together on this. So, you know, we're gonna sign a pledge, we're gonna not drink, and we're gonna get together and we're gonna do it because we all need to do it. And they did it, okay? And these are a bunch of charismatic, crazy Baltimoreans, and they just started, you know, bringing other people in. And I've got to tell you, within 4 years, the Washingtonians had grown to almost 500,000 people. That's faster than Alcoholics Anonymous ever grew. And those 500,000 people were sober as long as they were sticking together. However, what happened was there was some infighting. You know, they got involved in other things. There was the slavery issue, and there was, you know, people that wanted to be dry, people that didn't think that we should tell other people to be, you know. And then there was charismatics who wanted to like run the groups and change the formats, and you know, they didn't have any traditions back then. So, you know, you're gonna do it my way or whatever. I'll start another meeting over here and do it my way if you don't do it my way. And does this, any of this sound familiar, you know? And I know that that's how AA grows, you know, and it's actually a good thing. But anyway, that's what happened. And they, because they didn't have any traditions or any service structure, they broke apart. And most of those 500,000 or so people ended up dying drunk because there was a power in the cohesion of people not drinking and banding together to not drink. There was the power of the fellowship was going on back there. And there was some religious stuff too, but it was more about the fellowship. They disappear. Comes the turn of the century, and a couple of different movements started. One of them was the Emmanuel movement, which I don't really know a hell of a lot about. A lot of people are studying it right now, so pretty soon some scholarship is going to become available that'll really shed some light on alcoholism as it related to the Emmanuel movement. But another was a thing called the Oxford Group. And the Oxford Group was started by a guy named Frank Buckman. Now, this guy was beautiful. He wasn't an alcoholic, but we can relate to him because he had resentments. He was put in charge of, in Allentown, Pennsylvania, believe it or not, he was put in charge of a youth hostel for boys. This is back when YMCAs really were YMCAs, you know? Like now they're gymnasiums. Well, YMCAs back in the day were young men's Christian association. And it was about God and it was about religion. It wasn't about pumping weights. Anyway, so he gets put in charge of this youth hostel. And there's a board of directors, this nosy, meddlesome board of directors that's like telling him how to run his deal. and he gets a resentment and he tells everybody off and he quits in a huff and he disappears. And he goes over to England, and he's hanging around England, and he hears this person preach. He goes to one of these church services, and this woman gets up there, and she's just like one of these speakers that just like rocks your socks. You know, she would be like walking in on Clancy the first time you ever go to an AA meeting or something. It's like, whoa. And it changed his life. And he decided at that period of time that he's going to get back in touch with the Christian fundamentals that were being practiced in first century Christianity. Back when the apostles were hanging around, you know? I mean, real, bare bones, keep it simple Christianity. So he decides that that's what he's going to do. So, he studies, what they were doing. What were some of the practices that the first century Christians were doing? Well, they were praying and meditating. You know, they were making amends and restitution for harms that were done. They were being of service to others. They were openly sharing, their sins and defects with each other. There was a number of things that they were doing. So he starts to put together this little list of things that he's going to do. And one of them is amends. And he decides that he owes these board of director people amends. So he decides that he's in England. That's back when you didn't just jump on the red eye, you know, and fly back to Allentown, Pennsylvania. He decides he's going to write a letter to each one of these board of director individuals. And he does, admitting his wrongs, expressing his desire to be a changed individual and to make right those wrongs, however they would like him to do so. Now, he did this with the board of directors. He did it with other people. Basically, what he was doing was he was taking the actions, the spiritual actions that we take that bring about a spiritual awakening. He has a spiritual awakening. And once you've had a spiritual awakening, the next thing you do is you get involved in service and you try to pass it on. It's the evolution of the spiritual awakening. That's what you do. So he starts to carry the message. And a group of people start to get together over in England, and they were named the Oxford Group because they were mainly students at Oxford University interesting. He's getting these people interested in this way of life, and it had a lot to do with getting together on weekends and, you know, doing the spiritual exercises, trying to bring other people in, trying to lead a correct life, trying to lead a Christian life. Well, along around this time, it started coming across the ocean to America, and a lot of people started to get involved in America. This one man who starts to get involved is Sam Shoemaker in New York City. He becomes the representative in the New York area, New York metropolitan area, for the Oxford Group. And he's got like a mission alongside of his church, a Cavalry Street Mission. It's a Cavalry Church he's the rector of, and he's got the mission. And he kind of turns this mission into an Oxford Group headquarters. Now, along around this time, there's a man named Bill Wilson who's drinking a little bit. Okay. He's a piece of work. He's one of these guys that, you know, he is, every single chance he gets, he builds up a bright outlook for his family and brings it crashing down around him in a series of senseless sprees. But Bill Wilson is intelligent. He's a smart guy. He can recognize the fact that alcohol is getting the best of him. And as he's on his way down, he makes a bunch of all kinds of different attempts to try to control the drinking, to try to quit drinking, you know, like we've all done before we finally decided that it's bad enough to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, he's doing all this stuff, but there was no Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, he's got a brother-in-law who's a physician, and this brother-in-law recommends to him that there's this place called the Towns Hospital in New York City. And at the time, the Towns Hospital was probably one of the most most well-respected hospitals for the treatment of alcohol and drug addiction that was around. I mean, they didn't have the rehabs and the detoxes that popped up in the 60s and 70s around here. Very rarely would you find a place that would specialize in alcohol and drug addiction treatment. Usually they didn't even want you in the hospital if you were an alcoholic. A lot of times they'd turn you away at the door back in those days if you're an alcoholic. They just didn't, you know, you're doing it to yourself. We've got really sick people in here. You know, get out of here. And that was the attitude they had. But this one place, Charlie Towns was his name. He started this thing and he hired a man called Dr. Silkworth. Dr. Silkworth had worked there for a number of years, and he had treated something like 20,000 alcoholics or drug addicts that had run through this place. And he noticed some things that were very important. He noticed that if you had gone down the scale past a certain point, there was nothing he could do for you. They could detox you, but they knew that you were going to drink again, and you were either going to come back or you were going to die. He knew that maybe there was a marginal amount of people that could be helped by separating them, physically separating them from drugs and alcohol. There was a small percentage of people that could be helped. But if you were an alcoholic, that meant that you were below that line, and whatever he did, he just knew it was temporary, so they charged a lot of money. And back then it was because, you know, and you had to pay. You had to pay like up front, yeah. But it was about $200 at that time, which is about, it equates to about the $13,000 that you pay now for the 28 days of the big book and the pat on the butt to AA. Anyway, I digress. The brother-in-law says you should go to Towns Hospital, Bill. You know, you're drunk as a goat all the time. You got Lois working at the 5 and 10. You know, you're drinking the bathtub gin. You know, everything you've ever tried, you've failed at. You know, you're about to lose your house. Why don't you go to Charlie Towns' hospital? So that's what he does. And he signs himself in. I think he was there maybe 10 times. You know, that's typical for us. You know, we have to learn the same lesson multiple times. But anyway, at this time that he's going through the detoxing process, he's also becoming exposed to the Oxford Group. And here's how it happens. There's this great series. I mean, if you look at these series of coincidences, you're like, you know, the hand of God was like on all these people. You know, he was laughing while he was holding his hand on everybody because it's just such a crazy story. But the hand of God was on. Up in Vermont, there was a bunch of people that would summer up in Vermont. And Bill Wilson was one of them, you know, and Ebbie Thatcher was one of them. And Roland Hazard, I think, was somehow tied in with these Vermont summerers. Whatever happened to, like, summering, you know? I get, like, a week vacation. I don't know about you guys. Anyway, yeah, I could see telling my boss, yeah, I'm going summering in Vermont. I'll talk to you in mid-September or so. You know, those were the days. Anyway, so there's a bunch of guys, and there's this guy, Ebbie Thatcher. He's like the town drunk. He's an imbecile. His family is kind of well-to-do. I think that they were like, his uncle was the governor at one period of time in New York State or some crazy. I mean, they're kind of the well-to-do Thatchers. And they said, we got to get rid of this guy. He's embarrassing everybody. You know, he's in the paper for, you know, public intoxication. I know. We'll send them up to our house in Vermont that we summer in. So they send them up there and get rid of them. This one time he's like driving, you know, back then they drove drunk just like they do today. And he drove through this person's house into their kitchen, you know, and they're like kind of surprised because there's a Pontiac in the kitchen. And he rolls down his window and he goes, got any coffee? You know, so he's in front of the judge for that one. You better watch out. I don't care if you are a Thatcher, you know, I'll throw your butt in jail. So he's good for a little while, and you know how we start projects. We're great at starting projects, and we never finish them, especially when we're drinking. He decides, I'm going to paint the house for the family. You know, they'll love that. I'm living up here for free. I might as well do some. So, you know, he paints about, you know, 10 square feet a day, and then, you know, sits back and drinks and, you know, admires his work. And this one day he had painted a little bit, and the birds, the pigeons and stuff were like landing on. He just painted this, and there's like pigeons up there. So he gets a resentment and gets out his shotgun. This is also back in the day when everybody had a shotgun, you know. So he's like, bleesh, bleesh, starts shooting off the shotguns, like blowing holes in the house. And the neighbors, you know, are concerned, you know. So they call Barney Fife, you know, and he comes down and he drags him in front of the judge one more time. Now, I mean, I have to tell this story backwards because that's the only way it works. Now there's an individual called Roland Hazard. Roland was another moneyed man. I mean, if you go up to one of the churches in Boston, still to this day, one of the giant picture stained glass windows is like dedicated to the Hazards, because they were another well-to-do family in the Rhode Island area. The Rhode Island Hazards. Anyway, this individual was another alcoholic, and he was drinking himself to death and embarrassing, you know, his family. And, but he had money out the wazoo. He had as much money as you could possibly have. So he decides that he can't stop drinking. So he's going to go to Europe and get treated, by Sigmund Freud. Because he's got the money, he's going to go see Sigmund. Because Sigmund's doing some serious stuff back at this period of time. You know, he's like the guy. And Sigmund wouldn't see him because he wasn't taking on anybody new. So the next guy down the scale was a guy named Carl Jung. And we're very lucky that he picked Carl Jung, because Carl Jung believed in God. Sigmund Freud believed in you want to kill your father and have relations with your mother. So there was like a disparity between these two people. So we're real lucky he didn't go to Freud. And I'm saying it'd be a whole different program if that happened. So he goes to Carl Jung, and Carl Jung treats him. The story is he treats him for about a year, and he's on his way home, and he's leaving Vienna or wherever it is. And he doesn't even get to Paris to get on the boat to come home. He doesn't even make it that far. He's drunk on the train, you know what I mean? And so he's just spent like 70 grand or something with Carl Jung. So he goes back there. He's mad. He's like, what the hell is wrong with me? I spent a year like you shrunk my head so much it could fit on a mantle. You know, and I didn't even make it out of town, and I'm drunk again. What is going on? So the guy says, all right, you know, I was worried about this. You know, I think that you are a hopeless alcoholic, and unless you're locked up, you're going to die or go insane. Sorry. So he's like, isn't there something that can help? And he goes, well, you know, there have been cases in the past. They're few and far between. They're phenomenon. You can't make them happen. They're phenomenon. But every once in a while, someone that's hopeless like you gets involved in an evangelical religious movement, and that the evangelism of it all kind of just swoops you up, and you're able to recover from alcoholism, because it creates such a profound change in your attitude and outlook on life. You know, you're able to recover. He goes, if I were you, I'd join up with the rollers about as quick as you can. And, I'm sure he took this real well. And, so he goes back to America, and he's looking around for the rollinest rollers he can find. And he finds the Oxford Group. So he joins the Oxford Group. He gets and stays sober. Part of the Oxford Group is witnessing, which is what really our 12th step is carrying the message. Well, in the Oxford Group, you witness to other people, and you try to get them to start living a spiritual life, try to get them to start getting on their feet. as far as a moral code of living. So Roland Hazard decides, hears about Ebbie Thatcher after he's shooting the birds off of his house, and he knows the judge. So he goes to the judge, and here's Ebbie Thatcher in front of the judge about to go away for 2 or 3 years, and he says to the judge, "Judge, wait a minute now. I'll tell you what, give me a chance with this guy. Let me release him into my custody." This is another thing they don't do anymore, you know? Imagine, "I'd like to be released into his custody if you don't mind." I mean, they just don't do that anymore. But they used to do that. And they released Ebbie Thatcher into Roland Hazard's custody. Roland Hazard grabs him and says, "Let's get to New York. Let's get out of town fast." Gets to New York. And now they're they're down with Sam Shoemaker in the Episcopal Parish House doing their Oxford Group thing. All right. Well, one day, Ebbie Thatcher, who used to hang out with Bill Wilson up while they were summering in Vermont, hears that Bill's not doing too good, so he decides to go over and pay a visit. So he goes over and he pays a visit, and he knocks on Bill's door. "I'm coming over." He calls him up. "I'm coming over." And he shows up there, and Bill is thinking, "Man, now at least I got somebody to drink with. Has anybody in here gotten to the point you're drinking where there's nobody drinking with you anymore? You know, you are not to be drank with. You know, and you're just sitting there in the house drinking, and people like walking on eggshells around you because you're like a time bomb." And I mean, that's kind of like what Bill Wilson was not the social butterfly anymore. You know, he was drinking toilet bowl gin. You know what bathtub gin is? It's distilled water, grain alcohol, and some juniper berries. And he'd mix it up in his bathtub, you know? I mean, poor Lois had the shower. Anyway, so he shows up at the house, and he says, "Bill, I've got religion. Our favorite thing to hear from somebody, you know, when we're trying to enjoy a drink. Oh boy, you know? Tell me more. You got any Watchtower magazines? What, you know?" So Bill is like, oh no, you know, but like he's like lonely, and so he lets the guy talk, and he starts talking, and he starts to become convinced that this guy is sober. I mean, Ebbie Thatcher was a worse drunk than Bill, you know. I mean, at least Bill had jobs, you know. Ebbie practically never worked. So he starts to become convinced of two things. Now, number one, at Towns Hospital, he became convinced that he was suffering from an illness. All right? He was suffering from an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body, because he comes out of one of his last detoxes, and he gets his last detox, actually, and he gets a vision. He gets a vision, and the clouds part, and he's able to kind of see a little the truth about his alcoholism, and he had had talks with Dr. Silkworth earlier, and Dr. Silkworth had explained that he believes it's a condition, it's not a moral failing, it's a condition of the body and mind. So he learned in Towns Hospital a little bit about alcoholism, and now Ebbie Thatcher is bringing to him at his kitchen table the message of recovery, of how to recover from the illness, alcoholism. He starts to become convinced of this. And on all these crazy situations are taking place around him. He has one more drunk after seeing Ebbie. He ends up back in Towns Hospital one more time. And during that period of time, if you'll closely examine his story in the Big Book, it goes over the spiritual experience that he had sitting on his bed. That's when he had that vision of light, and the wind blew up his butt and all that, and he has that experience, and then he starts to work some of the principles that Ebbie Thatcher had taught him about, like inventory and confession, and the need to do restitution, the need to turn your will and your life over to God. all of the tenants of the Oxford Group, which later became our Steps. Bill Wilson becomes willing to do this. Bill Wilson becomes willing to do whatever Ebby Thatcher and his buddies are doing. Because Ebby Thatcher is like AAs. He's bringing a lot of people into the hospital. He's bringing all these Oxford Group people into the hospital. Bill is getting convinced of all this stuff, okay? He gets sober and he stays sober. And he's, for the first 6 months of Bill Wilson's life, he's just not drinking and going to meetings. He'd done a little bit of step work. He'd done a little bit of amends work, a little bit of prayer work, whatever. But he's not drinking. He's going to meetings and he's working some spiritual principles. And the time comes, he's trying to put his life back together, and he's a Wall Street guy. You have to understand, the two co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, one of them was a really bad proctologist, and the other was this shyster Wall Street guy that just tried to talk you out of your money. And you know, this didn't change after they got sober, you know. So anyway, what happened was he got involved with this deal. He was going to go to Akron, Ohio, the tire capital of the world. So he's going to be president. And they get out there, and it all falls apart. It all falls apart. He's not the president. As a matter of fact, everybody gets mad at him because it didn't work for some reason. He miscalculated the stock value or something, you know. And everybody leaves, and he's stuck there. He doesn't even have the money to go home, you know. And he's at 6 months sober, and he'd been trying to get people sober back in New York. Now he's all alone. The business thing had just failed. He's got just enough money to get drunk, and he walks into this hotel with a bar. And this is the period of time where it could have gone either way. You know, it really could have gone either way. He could have gone into the bar and started drinking, or he could have done what he did. And all of our lives rested on the fact that instead of going into the bar and starting to drink, which he was really starting to obsess about, what he did was he went to the phone and he had a dollar and he got like 20 nickels. And each of the hotels back then used to have church directories and the phone numbers for all the different churches. And he started calling up church people. And this is what he would say. He had to call about 14 people before he finally got somebody to talk to him, because this is what he would do. Hi, Reverend. My name's Bill Wilson. I'm a rummy from New York. I want to talk to another rummy. Click. Hello? Hello? You know, nope. Get out of here. Well, finally, he calls this guy, Walter Tunks. And Walter Tunks has just had the Oxford Group sweep through Akron. What happened was, a great story, there was this guy, Bud Firestone. He was one of the Firestone dudes, okay? And he was like, you know that movie Arthur? Like the drunken heir to the fortune, you know, in the limos, like staggered around? That was Bud Firestone. So what happened was, you know, the big Firestone money is trying to get this guy's like an embarrassment. So what happens is the Oxford Group sweeps through town and gets Bud sober. I mean, if they can get Bud sober, they can do anything. So what happened was that there was all this furor in Akron about, you know, as soon as Bud got sober, the Firestones invited the whole Oxford Group contingent, you know, like 2,000 of them came out to Akron and like inundated all the churches. So what had happened is this guy, Walter Tunks, understood a little bit about the Oxford Group, a little bit about what Bill Wilson was talking about, and said, look, can't help you right now, but I'll tell you what, give me a call tomorrow and I'll set something up. He set something up over at the Henrietta Cyberling. She was an estranged wife of one of the Cyberlings, who were another, you know, tire manufacturing mogul type family. Anyway, what happened was, Henrietta, real funny story, Dr. Bob had gotten involved in the Oxford Group when they came through because his wife was concerned about his drinking. Now here he is. Dr. Bob is a proctologist in Akron, and he's running out of proctors to work on. You know what I'm saying? Nobody wants this dude going anywhere near their proctor, because what's happening? He's got a real reputation in the hospital as being a drunk, you know? And there was a really great saying that was going around the hospital. You know, you let Bob Smith work on you, you're betting your ass. And that's, you could lose it, you know? And that's really the way it was, because he'd have the wrong scalpel or something, you know? And so he's running out of practice, and he's losing money, and he doesn't have, you know, it's really bad. So his wife, Ann Smith, is dragging him off to these meetings, Oxford Group meetings, and he's sitting there all frumpy, you know, he's coming late and leaving early. And he's just not really with all this stuff. But he's going for a couple of years before Bill Wilson pulls into town. And just before Bill Wilson pulls into town, Ann Smith gets together with Henrietta and says, look, we all know Bob is a closet drinker. He's drinking by himself. He's sneaking drinks. If we could get him to admit it, you know, we might be able to help him. So they decide, here's how they do it. They decide that it's going to be a tell your deepest, darkest secret meeting. And they start going around the room and telling their deepest, darkest secret. And then they get to Dr. Bob and they're like, you know, okay, here it is. And he goes, my secret is, I'm a closet drinker. Oh, like this, right? And it finally comes out. So, you know, it's like the milkman knew, you know what I mean? The people with the lost proctors especially knew. But anyway, so here he is. He's admitted it finally. So now they can move on him, you know? So all of a sudden, Walter Tonks calls up Henrietta Cyberling. Henrietta says, there's somebody that's sober from New York that wants to talk to an alcoholic, a drunk. Let's get Dr. Bob over there. So they try to get Dr. Bob over there, but it was Mother's Day. And he had come home with a potted plant for his wife. There you go, honey. And he hit the floor and that was it. There's not going to be any waking up. He was more potted than the plant. So there was no waking him up. So they arranged it for the next day. Now, he's lizard-eyed like a bastard. He's like hungover. He's like, ugh, I got to meet with who? So he goes, I'll give this bird 20 minutes. That's all, Henrietta. I'll do it for you. So he comes over. He's all hungover. And Bill Wilson swings into town. Hi. You an alcoholic? I'm an alcoholic too. Let me tell you my story. And, so what happens is right then and there, they make an identification with each other. Now, Dr. Bob had been going to Oxford Group meetings forever. But he didn't really understand what powerlessness was about. He didn't really understand what was wrong with him. So he didn't buy into all the spiritual stuff. He especially wasn't real keen on making amends. You know? How exactly do you go up to somebody and say, I'm sorry you lost your ass? You know? Is there anything I can do to make it better? How do you do that? So he's not real interested in the spiritual course of action. But when Bill Wilson goes up and explains to him exactly what's going on, that you have an allergy to the body, an obsession of the mind, you know, unmanageability rules the day. He finally sees what he's up against and decides to work the program. Now, he starts working the program. You know, here's, you know, Bill Wilson, like, moves into his house. Here's this guy, like, with no money, you know. Hey, my new friend in Akron. You know, I'll call my wife. Hey, I won't be home for a couple months, honey. You know. Moving in with my new best friend, Dr. Bob, that I met yesterday. And, so that's what he does. He moves in with Dr. Bob. And, for a couple of months, they're working with each other. And Ann Smith is, you know, teaching them all this Oxford Group spiritual stuff. That is where our program came from Ann Smith teaching Bill Wilson and Bob Smith the spiritual principles inherent in first century Christianity. That's where our steps came from. Anyway. What happens is, Dr. Bob gets up to the point where he's about to go make amends, and he just goes, I can't do it. It'll ruin me. You know, they felt like telling him, you're already ruined, Mom, you know? Who the hell's gonna let you operate on him? But there was a few people that, like, were newcomers in town or somebody that he could get. So he was afraid that if he was gonna admit he was an alcoholic, nobody would ever let him touch him again. Well, what happens is, there's a convention in Atlantic City that he wants to go to. It's a medical convention. You know, it's like, have you ever worked with a sponsee who's sober about 2 weeks and they say, I'm going on tour with the Grateful Dead? You're like, what? Well, I always tour with the Dead in August. Yeah, I mean, you know, and Bill is like, Bob, I don't know if going to Atlantic City for a convention is really a good idea. But, you know, if you really have to, so Bob gets on a train, doesn't even make it to Atlantic City. He's boiled like an owl, probably halfway there. Because they knew somebody on the train, there was like a nurse on the train that called up Ann and said, you gotta come wheel your husband home, you know, he's flat on his back in the coach section. You know, so they went down and they like wheeled him off of the train. He never even got to Atlantic City. So this is devastating. You know, he was sober for a month or two and, you know, he drank and what are we going to do? And what happened is he has to do an operation the next day. All right. You know that story, Dr. Bob's nightmare? Dr. Bob's patient's nightmare is more like it. Because what they do is he's like shaking his detox and he's seeing things, you know, and he's got to go operate on somebody. So Bill is like, holy shit. Anyway, I've got to operate. So, okay, Bill. So here, take some of these downers, you know, gives him a handful of downers and a couple of beers. Now get in there, you know, stir up that dude up and go. And so he goes in there and he does the operation, you know, and we don't hear much from that guy after that. But right after the operation, he leaves the hospital, he disappears, and nobody sees him for the next 6 hours or so. You know what he's doing? He's going up one side of the street and down the other making amends. He's knocking on the doors. He's saying, listen, I'm an alcoholic. You know, I've caused some harm. I'm trying to get my life straight. Blah, 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 blah. You know, I hope I didn't operate on you in a blackout. And he's making his amends. He comes back. That's really the day. 69 years ago was that particular day. That's when we date the birth of Alcoholics Anonymous, Dr. Bob's last drink, and hopefully last bad operation. Anyway, we got these two guys. We got these two guys running around. They decide that they need to start working with alcoholics. Okay, they've learned a lot about the spiritual program. They need to start working with alcoholics, and the first guy they start to work with is a man named Bill Dodson. This is a lawyer. This guy was a lawyer in Akron, and he became such a terrible alcoholic that when he would be detoxing, he'd be completely psychotic, you know. Dr. Bob goes into the hospital and asks a nurse, I think we've got a cure for alcoholism. Are there any drunks in the building that we could work this cure on? And the nurse looks him dead in the eye and goes, have you tried it, Bob? He's like, oh, she knows. But anyway, they have this one guy and she goes, yeah, we've got a corker. This guy just blackened the eyes of one of the nurses the night before and is like a little bit remorseful. You know, you ever come out of a blackout and I did what? Oh my God. So this guy's like strapped down to the bed and, you know, he's just suicidally depressed. And in walk, Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson. And they start saying, you know, we've got a cure, for drunkenness. We have learned what you need to do to be able to stay sober. And this individual got sober and stayed sober the rest of his life, Bill Dodson. I've actually heard his story on tape. If you're new or just coming back, I don't really recommend it because it'll put you to sleep in about a minute and a half. He might have been a good lawyer, but as far as an orator, he was pretty slow. Anyway, they start working with all these people, and you know, there was the first 13th step on Dr. Bob's operating table. That would have been a visual, huh? Just a lot of crazy stuff is going on. Bill, meanwhile, goes back to New York City, and he starts working with people. And there's a big difference between New York City and Akron. The people in Akron were getting sober. The people in New York City were not doing so well. And if you really start looking into the history of this stuff, you'll see that there was a difference in the spiritual exercises that were required in Akron, because you didn't have a sufficient desire to stop drinking if you weren't taking them, and that were kind of optional in New York. And that's interesting to look at. Now, many things happened in AA. I'll finish up with just a few of them here. One of the things was they started to grow, and they had maybe 60 or 80 people in the fellowship. And it was at the period of time where they really thought they need to spread this message. They need to get this out, because there's a lot of drunks that are dying. And if they only knew what we knew, they wouldn't die. So there's three things that Bill Wilson wanted to do. One of them was he wanted to start a chain of hospitals for alcoholics, similar to Towns Hospital. That would require a lot of money. He wanted to train and develop paid missionaries who would go out to the different cities or whatever and carry the message of AA. And then he wanted to write a book detailing the specific recovery methodology that they employed in Akron mainly, and some of the things that they did in New York. He decided to do this, and he brings this up at the group conscious meeting in New York. Now, you can imagine the group conscience meetings back that time weren't much different than the ones we have today. You know, they're like slow root canal with no Novocaine. And it was really difficult. They threw out the idea of the missionaries. They couldn't afford the hospitals, so they were left with one thing, writing the book. So, okay, we're going to write the book. So who's going to write the book? Well, Bill Wilson's going to write the book. So he starts writing the book, and he starts bringing the chapters into the meetings. And they start making him change everything. So he gets to the point where he finishes chapter 5, and he says, look, guys, I can't take it anymore. You know, we have to have a meeting on every sentence. I'll tell you what, I'm not writing the book anymore unless I can write it my way. Either I write it my way or you write it. You know, figure it out. Well, the group didn't want to release control over the content of the book, but they didn't want to write it. You know, I'm not writing nothing. So they finally acquiesced and said, okay, go ahead, have it your way, write the book your way. So you'll see between chapter 5 and chapter 6, there's a huge difference. It goes from what we did and what we recommend to you better, you know, or you're going to die a miserable, horrible death drowning in your own blood. You know, it's just like there's a difference in perspective in the book between those chapters. So Bill started to be able to do what he wanted to do. Anyway, it came time to put these books together. Who's going to pay for these books? Well, the Reader's Digest, there was a guy in the Reader's Digest who became interested in Alcoholics Anonymous, because they went there and they said, you know, we're 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. What do you think about that? Wow, that might make a good article for our magazine. So I'll tell you what, you start writing your book when you have most of the chapters done for your book, you come back to me and we'll work something out. So Bill now has got the promise, he thinks, of Reader's Digest to get all this stuff, to get all this publicity. And what happens is he does all the work, he goes back to Reader's Digest, and the guy goes, who are you? Bill who? Oh yeah, I remember you. Yeah, I thought that was a good idea at that time about alcoholics, but I talked about it with some of our editors. They don't want to touch it. You know, so he's like, oh, we've got no publicity. So they decide, how are we going to pay for these books? So he does what he does best. He puts together a fraudulent stock scheme. All right? He goes to the store and he buys all these blank stock certificates and fills them all out. Says, here's 200 shares, here's 200 shares, you're going to be rich. And even a couple of alcoholics even fell for it and started buying shares. You know, there's nothing legal backing any of this up. You know, it's funny. But anyway, you know, they pull all, I mean, this is like this dysfunctional group of guys. You know, I mean, I would give anything for like a videotape of one of those early meetings, you know, see what the hell happened. We got our name. Here's how we got our name. There was a guy who was influential in putting the New Yorker magazine together, okay? And he ended up in Greystone Hospital because he was nuts. He drank himself into alcoholic insanity, chirped like a squirrel, this guy.
And what they used to do was they used to have permission to drag drunks out of Greystone Hospital and bring them to the meetings, you know? Fill the chairs up. And there was this one guy, all he did was like rock. He was like, and he was against the wall this one day, and he just kept mumbling something. And somebody goes, what the hell is that nut mumbling? You know, so somebody goes over and listens, and he's going, anonymous alcoholic. Anonymous alcoholic. Anonymous alcoholic. So that's how we got our name. You know, a nut. Yeah, I swear to God. So when you think that, you know, when you're thinking to yourself, you know, I'm a member of the prestigious Alcoholics Anonymous, and you start getting a little bit of grandiosity about it all. Try to remember where we came from, you know, like the guy that was putting the fraudulent stock deals together and the proctologist that everybody was running down the medical halls trying to get away from. And, you know, these two men put together, especially Bill Wilson, put together the most significant social movement of the last 500 years. They did by accident. You know what I mean? Maybe there was some divine guidance going on, but they didn't have what it took to do what they did. You know what I mean? They didn't have the brains to do what they did. But I'll tell you what, I am one person that is incredibly grateful that all of these individuals existed. I will always be 100% grateful to the people who've come before me, because I wouldn't be alive today without it. I hope you've enjoyed the lighter side of AA history here tonight. And again, remember, it's probably not accurate, but the story is true. Thanks a lot.